The headlines this hour. Over 100 Palestinians are killed in Israeli airstrikes in Jabalia and the Gaza Strip, as the total death toll from 73 days of onslaught nears 19,000. Yemeni resistance forces target more Israeli-bound vessels in the Red Sea, retaliation for the regime's genocide in Gaza. And the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has launched a long-range ballistic missile capable of striking the U.S.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Day 73 of the Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip, where fresh airstrikes and shelling have killed scores of Palestinian civilians. Israeli airstrikes took the lives of 100 people in the city of Jabalia, the northern part of the Strip. In the Nuseirat camp in central Gaza, at least 50 people were killed in air raids targeting residential buildings. Several areas of Gaza City have been struck as well. As a result, dozens of dead bodies were brought to Al-Shifa Hospital. The southern city of Khan Yunis witnessed fresh attacks also. The regime's artillery shelled the maternity ward of Nasser Hospital, killing a teenage girl and wounding a number of other people. The Palestinian Red Crescent has slammed as extremely dangerous the shelling of the medical facility in Khan Yunis. Nearly 19,000 people, mostly women and children, have been killed in Israeli attacks in Gaza since the launch of the regime's military onslaught on October 7. The senior member of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the group will not enter into a prisoner swap agreement with Israel unless the regime stops its onslaught on Gaza. Khalil al-Hayya says that it would not be sensible to sign a prisoner exchange deal while Palestinians are under fire. He also says Hamas has what it takes to resist for months, adding whoever thinks of a post-Hamas era is in a delusion. Al-Hayya has urged Muslim countries to force the Israeli regime into allowing humanitarian aid to enter Gaza. The top Hamas official argued that the entry of 100 trucks with relief aid is not enough at all for besieged Gazans. He says the resistance front will continue to counter the occupiers and to inflict further losses on them. Heavy fighting is underway in the Gaza Strip between Israeli forces and Palestinian resistance groups. The Al-Qassam Brigades says it hit two Israeli military vehicles with rockets. It says the group destroyed an Israeli tank in Deir al-Balah. Palestinian resistance fighters attacked a gathering of Israeli soldiers in Khan Yunis, leaving several soldiers dead and injured. The Al-Quds Brigades have also conducted retaliatory operations against Israeli forces. The group says it destroyed an Israeli Merkava tank and hit a gathering of regime soldiers in Shijaiya, inflicting heavy losses on them. The regime has so far confirmed the death of 121 forces in Gaza. However, Hamas says the casualties among Israeli forces are much higher and that the regime is hiding the real number. Saad Nimr is a professor of political science at Brzezinski University, who joins us. Welcome to the program. We are looking at over 100 Palestinians that have been murdered in the past 24 hours based on the reports that we've received, confirmed by a reporter. And this comes fresh from the visit of the U.S. National Security Advisor to the occupied territories, who claimed that it's going to take the high-intensity Israeli onslaught to a lower-intensity one, yet we see the opposite happening here. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that the Americans are under such a pressure, either from other countries around the world and also from the administration itself. But at the same time, they are still complying with what the Israeli wanted. And the Israeli, at this stage, they wanted to continue with this crazy war. And in spite of the fact that the American wanted them to ease a little bit the killing of the Palestinians and ease to the war results, but still the Israeli are continuing. And they claim that they are going for the fourth stage of the war, in which didn't started yet, but they are claiming that they are going for the fourth, and the fourth one is going to take months, according to them. In that stage, they are going to withdraw from Gaza and to stop the air raids, but at the same time, they have the right to do it whenever they want, against some specific targets or to assassinate some of the resistance movement leaders. That's what the Israeli wanted in this stage, which is for 3-4 months, according to them, and the war continues, but in a different kind of way. But that's what they wanted in the fourth stage. Now, this kind of stages, definitely, the Palestinian resistance are not going to accept at all. And if they continue to do strikes, then definitely the Palestinian resistance will continue to send rockets also to the major cities in Israel. So the whole idea is for Netanyahu and his government to make the war longer and to keep continue in his office as a prime minister in Israel. So he wanted to make the war longer and longer in this kind of strategy that he's adapting now in this fourth stage. So the war continues, but it is they choose what to hit and when to hit, and this is up to them to do it. But they will ease on the airstrikes generally, and the withdrawal of their vehicles and their land invasion tanks from Gaza to the borders, or a little bit inside Gaza, but on the borders of Gaza. And apparently the Americans are absolutely agreeing with that and going with them on that, since it is at least the ease a little bit on Gaza in the war results, which we are seeing now. It's just the crimes and murders and genocide against the Palestinians. Every day there are people who are being killed. But now the Israelis are in real problem because of what happened a few days ago, when they killed three of their own soldiers who were prisoners with the Palestinian resistance, and they managed to get out. And they killed them, and this have created a huge problem inside Israel itself. And demonstrations were all over in Israel, and especially for the families of the prisoners with the Palestinian resistance, and demanding that now we need to start talking. And which now apparently they started to send the head of the Mossad security forces to Norway. With the Qatari also prime minister foreign minister in Norway, with the Americans, and they are trying to bring in a new deal in a way or another. But the position of the Palestinian resistance is so solid, and they refuse to negotiate any releasing of prisoners without the end of the war, and to stop totally the war, not only a truce or ceasefire.
Thank you very much for that, Saad Nimr, professor of political science at Birzeit University. Thank you. Israeli forces kill more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank as they raid Farah refugee camp in the Jordan Valley. The Palestinian Health Ministry says four young Palestinians were killed by regime troopers during the incursion. The Palestinians were aged between 17 and 24. Israel has stepped up raids and attacks across the occupied territories since October 7. That is when the regime began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Since then, regime forces and settlers have killed more than 300 Palestinians and detained hundreds more across the West Bank. Two explosions have taken place in the waters off Yemen's coast. The British Maritime Authority says the blasts are reported in the vicinity of the Strait of Bab al-Mandab in the Red Sea. That is where the Yemeni military has been targeting ships linked with Israel over the regime's onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Earlier, our correspondent Yusuf Mowry joined us from Sana'a with more details.
These were actually warning shots that were fired from Ansarullah. We don't know whether it was unmanned drones or if they were missiles. It was most likely unmanned drones. Unmanned drones are being used to fire warning shots, and this has been the consistency with the Ansarullah's warning shots being sent out to vessels and ships linked to the Israeli regime, warning them not to approach, warning them not to continue their route to the port of occupied Palestine in Ilyak and in the port of Haifa in occupied Palestine. And if these ships and vessels, they do not follow the instructions, if they do not take heed of the warning, then they would shortly be targeted by a cruise missile and other forms of weapons like the unmanned drones, which have proven to be very effective in targeting Israeli-linked ships and vessels in the Red Sea and near Bab al-Mandab Strait.
While there has been no let-up in Israeli atrocities in Gaza, people across the world have also been equally unwavering in their support for Palestinians in the besieged strip. The French protesters called for a total and permanent ceasefire. They carried banners calling for the right of life for people of Gaza and expressed support for the struggle of Palestinians for freedom. Across the channel and in the southeastern UK city of Brighton, people also marched in support of Palestinians. The rally was a combination of 20 local groups, all calling for a ceasefire. Meanwhile, in the Canadian capital of Ottawa, protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted, "Free, free Palestine" at a Zara store. That is because of an ad campaign by the fashion brand featuring statues that were wrapped in white. Activists say the images resembled photos of corpses in white shrouds in Gaza. Zara withdrew the ad earlier in the week. New footage has been released showing Palestinian health officials holding a news conference in northern Gaza, running for cover as the sound of Israeli gunfire is heard nearby. Munir Al-Bursh, Director General of the Ministry of Health in Gaza, was delivering a statement outside of the Kamal Adwan Hospital when the incident happened. Israeli forces raided the hospital on Tuesday after besieging and shelling it for days, several days. On Saturday, doctors and other witnesses said Israeli forces bulldozed tents housing displaced and injured Palestinians inside the hospital compound and buried them alive. The Council on American Islamic Relations has called for a UN probe into the matter. The Palestinian Health Ministry has also demanded an immediate investigation. The hospital has been under a direct siege for 10 days in a row, with reports of Israeli forces shooting at anything in its vicinity. The structure now appears to be almost completely destroyed. Witnesses say Israeli forces attacked patients and doctors at Kamal Adwan Hospital during the raid and arrested medical personnel. Here are some testimonies.
"We've been displaced, and today they demolished the building, killing doctors, leaving nothing behind. They haven't even spared the doctors. Look, my son is there under the rubble, and I can't reach him. For God's sake, where are the Arab nations? Don't they see what's being done to us? They've been killing us since 1948. This is not a war."
"They have been injured and have been in the hospital for 10 days. As soon as the Israeli troops withdrew, I rushed to take them. As you can see, they suffer from total burns for no reason. They were left with no food or water and no care. There are other injured members of my family, but I wasn't able to carry them. After I arrived at the hospital, I witnessed massive destruction, an indescribable scene. Patients are scattered in every corner, beds are overturned, and medical material are damaged. There are no conditions conducive to sustaining life. I managed to carry them with my own hands to transport them to a safe place."
The head of the Roman Catholic Church has condemned the Israeli killing of two Christian women who had taken refuge in a church in Gaza City. Pope Francis says Tel Aviv is using, quote, terrorism tactics in Gaza, adding unarmed civilians are the targets of Israeli strikes. The pontiff referred to a statement by the Latin Patriarch of Al-Quds that said a mother and daughter were shot and killed in cold blood as they walked in the compound of Gaza's only Catholic church. One was killed as she tried to carry the other to safety. According to the statement, seven others were also injured. This is not the first time Israel has conducted attacks on religious sites. Back in October, the Greek Orthodox Church, where hundreds of people were taking shelter, was bombed, leaving at least 18 people, including children, dead. The Israeli army has also targeted many mosques during their onslaught on Gaza. The Israeli prime minister is facing harsh criticism at home over his handling of the issue of captives held by Hamas. Israelis have been piling up pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu since three of those captives were killed by the regime's own forces in Gaza some days ago. One of the three slain captives was buried near Tel Aviv on Sunday. During the funeral, his brother slammed the Israeli military for abandoning and murdering him. The three men were killed near Gaza City by invading Israeli troops on Friday. It sparked protests in Tel Aviv, where people vented their anger at Netanyahu and called on him to initiate negotiations to get captives released. More than 100 Israelis are still being held by Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza. That's after a week-long truce in late November, which saw Hamas swapping more than 100 captives with 240 Palestinian women and children held in Israeli jails. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has issued a statement saying that it targeted an Israeli military post where four regime forces were stationed. It comes after Israel carried out shelling inside of Lebanon. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh joined us earlier to tell us exactly what happened.
This morning, we woke up to the sound of heavy Israeli shelling, which was all around this area. This is the Marjayun area near the Khiyam town and Kfar Kila. Also, the Kfar Shuba Hills, Hezbollah launched two of its operations today. We have Hanita and Birkat Risha that were the Israeli posts that were targeted today at 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. by Hezbollah's resistance. We do have statements on those, but we also know from Israeli media that they heard the siren sounding in the settlement of Sa'asa, and they say that two anti-tank missiles struck the posts of the Israelis and Israeli hideouts in those settlements. They are using, of course, the so-called civilian settlements in order to take to stage, of course, their military presence, the Israeli soldiers, of course. And when you talk about the situation as a whole, we do know that there are daily resistance operations. We cannot really talk about a specific pattern, but what we can say, when it comes to Hezbollah, we know for sure they are hitting precise targets. They are using specific weapons. When they use different weapons that they can declare about, like, for example, the Burkan rocket, that has been used not very openly, not in, many times. It seems to have been used by Hezbollah as a precise rocket, which can be hit into areas that are a bit further off from the border, but at the same time, it's not even detected by the Iron Dome or by Israeli other defense systems. Up until now, they have not been able to detect it.
South Korea says the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has launched another long-range ballistic missile that landed in the waters east of the Korean Peninsula. Officials in Seoul and Tokyo say the missile can potentially strike the U.S. Japan's defense ministry says it was an intercontinental ballistic missile with a potential range of more than 15,000 kilometers. According to South Korea, the projectile flew up rather than across. This is a method Pyongyang employs in some weapons tests to avoid flying over neighboring countries. The launch followed the test of a shorter-range missile on Sunday night. The DPRK says its missile tests are in response to the persisting joint war games by the U.S. and its regional allies and their hostile rhetoric. Pyongyang regards such moves as rehearsals for invasion.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with Iran's sports champions and medalists of the 2023 Asian Games and the Asian Paragames. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh on November 22, 2023. I would like to thank our female athletes. I would like to thank the woman who carried the flag in the opening ceremony during this round of the Asian Games while wearing full hijab. She showed the identity and character of an Iranian woman to the entire world. I would like to thank the female athlete who refused to shake hands with a non-mahram man, not from her intimate family, during the awards ceremony. He extended his hand toward her, but she declined to take it. These are very significant things. These things are just as important as sports are, if not more. I would like to thank the woman who went to the podium with her baby. She went on the podium with her baby in her arms and received her medal. This was a symbolic move. In the world, this shows a woman respecting the role of the family and the role of a mother.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to thank the athletes who included their values and beliefs in their sports activities. They prostrated to God after their victory, raised their hands in the prayer in the middle of the sporting arena, kissed the Iranian flag, and prostrated on the flag. These are very important things. These are acts that not only demonstrate the identity of Iranian Islamic athlete, but also the identity of the Iranian nation before the eyes of hundreds of millions of spectators. These are not small things. Such a prostration is very different from the prostration that one does at home or in a mosque. This chador in such a situation is very different from the chador that someone wears on the streets of Tehran. I would like to thank the national soccer team, which showed their support for the Palestinian cause by wearing kifias when they came onto the field. I would like to thank each of the athletes who took a stand in one way or another in support of Palestine, declared their stance before the world, not in hiding, gifted their medals to the children of Gaza and the martyrs who were killed in a hospital, where the Zionist regime created a catastrophe. I would also like to thank the athletes who refused to compete with the athletes of the Zionist regime. The correctness of what they did has become clear today. The truth behind this is more apparent than ever today. These are things I am grateful for.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
UN agencies continue to sound the alarm bell over the desperate humanitarian situation in the besieged coastal territory. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that the people of Gaza are running out of time and options. Philippe Lazzaroni warned that Gaza is very far from an adequate humanitarian response.
The people of Gaza are running out of time and options as they face bombardment, deprivation, and disease in an ever, ever shrinking space.
He described the situation in Gaza as hell on earth and said people in the Palestinian territory are facing the darkest chapter of its history since 1948. He described seeing people halting in aid truck and in desperation and swallowing down the food found inside where they stood in the street. Further noted that the people of Gaza are now crammed into less than one-third of their original territory near the Egyptian border, and the dire situation might spark an exodus. The city of Rafah on the Egyptian border, the only crossing where aid is entering Gaza, has seen its population explode from 280,000 to more than 1 million.
Rafah is the epicenter of the displacement of the Gazan. There is over 1 million people who have fled in this governorate, and most of them, as we know, have been moved more than once since the beginning of the war. Rafah has quadrupled its number of people overnight, and especially when the offensive in the south has started.
UN officials have warned that any such exodus would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and it would make a problematic Palestinian problem more difficult. It is now widely believed that the Israeli regime is deliberately targeting residential areas and the critical infrastructure in Gaza in order to make the territory unlivable for its residents. Israel has already pushed the U.S. and its other Western allies to persuade Egypt to accept Palestinian people in the Sinai Peninsula.
It seems very difficult to us that if there was a population movement outside Gaza, I think that can only mean Egypt. It would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and that would make a solution to the Palestinian problem even more difficult.
The healthcare system is collapsing. Expect public order to completely break down soon. And an even worse situation could unfold, including epidemic diseases and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt. I said that we are facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system.
UNRWA and many other aid organizations have already issued serious warnings about the dire conditions in Gaza. The UN Humanitarian Office also said that Gaza faces a public health disaster due to the collapse of its health system and the spread of disease. Doctors in Gaza are warning about the spread of diseases, especially among children, due to overcrowding and unhygienic conditions of makeshift camps, as well as a lack of medicine and clean water there. The lack of food, clean water, and shelter have worn down hundreds of thousands of traumatized people, and with the health system on its knees, its inevitable epidemics will rip through the territory.
We all know that the healthcare system is or has collapsed. We've got a textbook formula for epidemics and a public health disaster. This is in part, of course, because the shelters have long ago exceeded their full capacity, with people lining up for hours just to get to a toilet.
According to the data compiled by the World Health Organization, from November 29th to December 10, cases of diarrhea in children under the age of 5 jumped 66% and climbed 55% for the rest of the population in the same period. The UN agency said the numbers were inevitably incomplete due to the meltdown of all systems and services in Gaza because of the war. Doctors of the pediatric ward at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza have told reporters that the ward was overrun with children suffering extreme dehydration, causing kidney failure in some cases, while severe diarrhea was four times higher than normal.
The conditions of the war have led to the spreading of a lot of epidemics and sicknesses, the first epidemic of which has been one of acute gastroenteritis, which we have most frequent cases of in the children's ward. There are a number of patients come with cases of extreme dehydration, some of which can get to the point of kidney failure or weakening kidney function. Things are very bad.
I have four children with gastrointestinal diseases and flu. My youngest son has a cold, but we don't have any medicine. I have never felt as helpless and miserable in my life as I do now.
Since the truce between Israel and Hamas collapsed on December 1, hundreds of thousands of people have moved to makeshift shelters, abandoned buildings, schools, and tents. Many others are sleeping in the open with little access to toilets or water to bathe.
Children sleep in the tent, while some adults have no choice but to sleep on the streets. There's no food, no water. The children lack milk and diapers. The situation is dire, with no sanitary conditions or toilets.
Gaza's 2.3 million people now find themselves in a daily struggle to find enough clean water to survive. Residents are forced to take seawater for daily use, despite health risks. The United Nations General Assembly has overwhelmingly passed a resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Israeli regime's months-long genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. The 193-member Assembly adopted the resolution with 153 votes in favor. 10 countries voted the resolution down,
including the U.S., in line with this unfaltering political support for the Israeli regime. The U.S., however, does not hold the veto power at the Assembly, unlike the U.N. Security Council, where it has blocked successive such resolutions. The resolution demands an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, as well as a swift and unconditional release of all captives. It also urges all parties to comply with international law. The vote is non-binding, but is seen as an expression of the views of the international community. It also increases pressure on Israel to end its onslaught on Palestinians. Ambassadors and other diplomats burst into applause at the vote count, which showed much higher support than an October 27 Arab-sponsored resolution that called for a humanitarian truce. Iran's permanent ambassador to the UN urged the international community to decisively address the barbaric crimes of Israel.
One member state, a permanent member of Security Council, misusing its unequal authority of veto power and in clear disregard to the united will of international community, has decided to stand with Israeli criminal regime and materially enable this regime in its ongoing massacre against civilians in Gaza. The United States blatantly opposing a ceasefire which means prescribing war violence and eventually more death for children and women in Gaza.
Meanwhile, Australia, a traditional ally of the U.S., has sided with the UN General Assembly resolution calling for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. It has been described a rare split with its close allies, the U.S. and the U.K.
Australia, alongside 152 other countries, was among the countries which voted in favour. In doing so, we joined Canada, New Zealand, Japan, France and India, and many other countries.
Now, the significance of this vote was that not only is it showing that the support that Israel had from many Western states especially for its military assault on Gaza is eroding, and even staunch supporters of Israel like Australia and like Canada are now saying we need a ceasefire.
World leaders must take a brave and bold stance against those who are fueling the flames of settler colonial violence.
And so what this shows is that Israel is isolated, the United States is isolated. The General Assembly, which is the world's parliament and which is the most democratic organ in the United Nations, has said, we overwhelmingly want an immediate ceasefire. Now, at the same time, and this is where sometimes you feel there's a parallel reality, you hear the United States voting against that, you see the United States voting against that resolution, and at the same time, words from the Biden administration about Israeli indiscriminate bombing.
Yemen is upping the ante in its retaliatory attacks against the Israeli regime, which has been pounding Gaza nonstop for over 2 months now, in what is internationally viewed as a genocidal onslaught. The spokesman for Yemen's armed forces has warned all shipping companies against dealing with Israel.
Due to the Zionist enemy's continuous committing of horrific massacres, genocide and siege against our brothers in Gaza, the Yemeni armed forces hereby announce the prohibition of the passage of ships heading to the Zionist entity of any nationality if the Gaza Strip does not receive the food and medicine it needs.
That's an escalation of an earlier Yemeni threat to prevent the movement of Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea and the Arabian Sea. Yemen carried out that threat, attacking two Israeli ships in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and seizing another Israeli-linked cargo ship in the Red Sea in a commando operation. That decision has forced Israeli shipping firms to change the route of their ships. Now, vowing to target non-Israeli ships moving to the occupied territories, Yemenis appear bent on really hurting the regime. The Arab country has also launched several missile and drone attacks against Israel as part of its campaign to support the Palestinians. Hossein El-Bukhaiti A senior Yemeni analyst says the Yemeni decision is consistent with international law.
If you have declared the war against a country, you have the right to stop any military ship or even a cargo ship if you think that this cargo ship is used in Israeli effort against the Palestinian people. Not only in the Red Sea, they could target it in the Gulf of Aden, they could target it in the Arabian Sea.
A look at Yemen's map shows these words hold water. The Red Sea is a strategic waterway that connects Asia, Africa, and Europe. Figures show about 10% of global trade passes through the Red Sea each year. Given that the global trade value stands at $96 trillion, the Red Sea handles $9.6 trillion worth of trade per year and an average of over $26 billion worth of trade per day. The Red Sea is also of significant importance for the Israeli regime. The port of Eilat handles the regime's trade with East Asian countries. It also handles Israeli oil imports from Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan. The Israeli regime has not officially commented on Yemen's threats and actions, but some Israeli media and analysts have expressed concern over the situation. They've warned that Yemenis could pose a serious threat to the Israeli maritime and economic interests in the Red Sea. Shortly after Yemen's announcement, Israeli media reported that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has asked the U.S. officials to do something to stop Yemen or the regime will target Yemen itself. But Yemeni officials appeared defiant, with Yemen's information minister, Saifullah al-Shami, now saying that they are ready to confront any military action against them. The officials are encouraged by million-strong marches that have been repeatedly held over Yemen over the past weeks. In those rallies, the Yemeni people, who themselves suffered for years from a similar US-backed onslaught and are still under a US-backed blockade similar to the siege of Gaza, called on the government to do something for Gaza amid the global silence and the Arab world's inaction. The big Yemeni announcement, which came as resistance groups in Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria have also stepped up anti-Israel and anti-US attacks, shows the region's patience over continuous Israeli massacres is wearing thin, especially after the US again blocked the UN Security Council from calling for an immediate halt to Israel's onslaught.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Ilm-e Fiqh az ulum-e sharifiye islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Alavi Tehrani. Please stay tuned.
تسلیم بود، تسلیم کلمیت بین یدیل.
We must be submissive towards Allah and the Ahlul Bayt as if a dead body is in the hands of a mortician before burial. If we are truly submissive before Imam al-Mahdi Jalallah, we must only listen to him. Love for Ahlul Bayt without being submissive to them has no value. Of course, among all the believers, there are only a few people who are submissive towards Ahlul Bayt.
Ummat Musa ba 71 firqe, 70 firqe ahl jahannam, yek guru ahl behesht.
In a conversation between Imam Ali alayhi salam and a Jewish person, Imam Ali alayhi salam talked about different sects among Jews, Christians, and Muslims, from whom only one sect will find salvation. Here Imam Ali alayhi salam refers to salvation of one group among all the sects. The people are those who are submissive towards the Wali or the guardian of Allah on earth. In better words, faith must be the real one if we want to reach salvation. True faith comes with love for Ahlul Bayt. Without being submissive towards Allah and the Ahlul Bayt, our faith has no value. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Alavi Tehrani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show focusing on investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. After Elon Musk bought Twitter, now known as X, he promised to restore free speech to the platform. But the multi-billionaire is being squeezed by the Zionist lobby to force him to reimpose censorship on commentary about Palestine. The previous incumbents caved in to an intense campaign by Zionist extremists and imposed shadow bans on this show, Professor David Miller, and myself. But after Musk took over, the bans were lifted on us and on numerous other accounts too. But the billion-dollar question now is, will he succumb to the pressure? Latif Arbochakra has this report about Musk's recent visit to the settler colony and the Zionist tactics being deployed against him.
The social media platform X has provided a vital lifeline to journalists debunking Israel's disinformation around its genocidal war on Gaza. Several lies that Israeli occupation forces pushed out were immediately discredited by investigative journalists on the site. For that reason, Elon Musk is simultaneously a key ally and target of the Zionist regime. Musk has been mobilized against by key Zionist lobby groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Center for Countering Digital Hate. And it is likely that his visit was an opportunity for the Zionist regime to apply more pressure on him to censor the social media platform. During the short pause in Israel's bombing of Gaza, the billionaire owner of the platform X, Elon Musk, traveled to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for an indoctrination session. While in occupied Palestine, he was taken on a guided tour of the Gaza settlement envelope by Netanyahu. A solemn picture was taken with Musk looking down at a baby cot, supposedly littered with bullets from the Palestinian resistance. However, it was revealed that those bullets matched those coming from Israeli tanks rather than Palestinian fighters. And as the war of disinformation continues, large US corporations like Walt Disney, Warner Brothers, and Comcast suspended their ads on X in protest against his alleged anti-Semitism. This has, of course, been lobbied for by Israel's spy agency, the Anti-Defamation League, for some time. The US government has even issued a statement condemning Musk for the abhorrent promotion of anti-Semitic and racist hate. In October, when Israel cut all electronic communications in Gaza, Musk offered to provide his Starlinks to internationally recognized aid organizations in the Strip. This infuriated the Israelis, who vetoed the idea immediately. While on his trip to the settler entity, Musk commented to Israeli President Isaac Herzog that he supported the idea of re-education camps in Gaza to prevent another generation of resistance. He also commented that he would help establish economic prosperity in the area. With the constant stream of contradictory messages, the battle for the soul of Elon Musk continues.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And I'm delighted to welcome Ghadi Francis as our guest today. Ghadi is a Lebanese war correspondent who's worked for Al Mayadeen, Al Jazeera and others, and over the years she's reported directly from conflict zones in Syria, Iraq and Yemen. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. What do you think went on with Elon Musk in the Zionist entity then? Interesting trip, wasn't it?
Well, very curious, wasn't it? I mean, we saw that footage, didn't we, of him with Netanyahu with his flak jacket on,
yes,
strolling around the kibbutz, looking perplexed and interested. And we saw all sorts of statements about how awful it was that the Israelis were facing what they were, and how From the River to the Sea was an anti-Semitic call for genocide and wouldn't be allowed henceforth on Twitter or X. So we saw, essentially, in that trip, we saw him becoming an obvious and stated Zionist. Now, of course, that's not quite the full story, but that's what we saw there. We saw him looking at that crib, remember? The crib with the bullets in it, which it transpired were not, in fact, resistance bullets, IDF or IOF bullets. So we saw a performance there, which looked very worrying for those who had believed his stories about freedom of expression.
Yeah. I mean, Ghadi, what's the opinion of the resistance access in the Middle East towards Musk, do you think?
Well, I don't know if I can really say the resistance access, because it's quite big, and like there's a spectrum of ideologies in the resistance access, and I'd say it is also the same when it comes to Elon Musk visit. Some people really paid attention to that and others found it irrelevant. As in, we've never expected more out of such personalities. Mm. For people in the Middle East, for people in the resistance of access, a big tech personality that has always been aligned with the U.S. foreign policy, and that does these kinds of businesses for them. We don't expect him to come and say free Palestine. I think for me personally, nothing was surprising.
No.
What he did wasn't surprising. And also there were these resurfacing anti-Semitic comments that he had done. And we have seen that in history previously, whether it's scientists or businessmen or actually Microsoft and other tech companies, when they do such things, they have to whitewash what they did, and they end up being first front line of the Zionist propaganda just to make up for what they had done previously. Mm. So when it comes to the axis of resistance, they never took Elon Musk as an ally. So I don't think the expectation was really more than that.
No, indeed. Well, David, I mean, how exactly then did the Anti-Defamation League and the Center for Countering Digital Hate actually lobby Elon Musk then?
Well, they did a number of different reports and accusations about him being anti-Semitic, but of course also they did a specific report on this program, if
indeed
you recall,
done
by the Center for Countering Digital Hate, an organization created in this country but also having a DC office. Which was also co-published by the ADL. Of course, that suggested that we were a vehicle for Iranian state propaganda and that we casually gave out anti-Semitic comments week after week. Entirely false, of course, and a report based on ridiculous research that hasn't even got names attached to it, so you can't tell who wrote it. So that was the way in which they did it. And of course, it's interesting that as you said at the beginning of the programme, that when he took over, our Twitter accounts, the Twitter account for the show, were labelled as Iran state-affiliated media. We were shadow banned, and all that fell away. And really, what you've seen with pro-Palestine accounts on Twitter in the last month or so is a massive increase in followers and reach, and that doesn't appear to be. There's some signs that there's a kind of rowing back on the algorithm in relation to that, in relation to particular accounts. But it doesn't, in general, appear to be the case. On the idea that somehow that Musk would outlaw from the river to the sea as a hashtag, well, I mean, it only massively increased after he said that. And I don't believe that anybody has been banned, as far as I'm aware, for using the hashtag. I certainly haven't been put into control measures for it. So it looks like that there's a real problem there for them, overwhelmingly, social media users on Facebook, on X, on Instagram, on TikTok are pro-Palestine.
Yeah.
And there's not much they can do about that.
Mm. Gandhi, I mean, how do you think Elon Musk's management of Twitter, or X as it's now known, compares to other platforms like Instagram, for example?
Well, if you want to compare to Meta, to Instagram and to Facebook, he'd look like the angel. Because the prohibitions...
It's a low bar, though, isn't it?
Really, because we've been, working our words around the shadow bans on Instagram and, melons and all kind of vegetables just to convey the message we want to say. It has also become something global. So if we want to compare that to X, formerly known as Twitter, well, it's still... we can still articulate our thoughts without being, slaughtered virtually like it's done on Instagram and Meta, but still it's not really safe out there, and we see it very it's like walking on eggshells when you really want to say, to speak your mind, and you're not being racist or it's not really hate or violence. When you want to articulate a thought of resistance, you are walking on eggshells, but you get all these trolls that are basically literally saying that you should be killed and that babies should be killed, and they're always there, and they don't get the same kind of security police.
No.
Well, this is up so far. This is what I've been seeing. It is not. There's no justice in regulating how we are being attacked, but there is always a police watching what our words are.
Mm.
Well, but still, it's not really as secure as it once was, because there's this one person who has been sitting next to Benjamin Netanyahu, and this is the person in charge. So we don't know when overnight, well, for example, I have a verified account. I don't know when overnight it wouldn't be verified anymore, because I've been saying free Palestine ever since I was born.
No, indeed,
so I'm not allowed to exist on X, probably.
Yeah. I mean, he's certainly a sort of an idiosyncratic sort of character, isn't he, Elon Musk? And, I mean, and some of the positions he's taken, David, do sort of indicate a degree of independence, don't they, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would take two examples. One is, of course, the example of Ukraine, where he started to say to the US government that they would have to start paying for Starlink. Mm. And then he also refused to allow them to have Starlink. On a particular moment when they were trying to attack the Crimea. So that the Pentagon didn't like that very much. The Americans didn't like that very much. So that was an indication of that he can't, that, you know, he was saying, we can't be used for aggressive purposes. And in a way, that's what he's saying on Gaza too, where he's talking about developing. Yes, he talked about re-education camps, of course, the ridiculousness that it was. But he also talked about regeneration, investing in Gaza. And of course, that means profits for him. But it's not quite as straightforward as a simple genocidal Zionist approach. I mean, I would also say that, you know, that when he came back from visiting the settler colony, he did that famous interview where he said about advertisers, they can go F themselves.
Yes, right? Indeed.
I mean, pretty extraordinary. Now, the people he's talking to there is the ADL and the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, who have been the ones who've been behind the advertiser boycott. Mm. So on the one hand, he's saying to Netanyahu, oh, well, I'm fully behind the Zionists and you shouldn't be calling for the end of Israel. On the other hand, he's saying to the ADL, absolutely not, I'm having nothing to do with you. So that's a real indication that there's something contradictory in his personality or his way of doing this, and it's partly, I guess, his kind of libertarian ideas about freedom and that kind of thing, which is behind that. But it's a deeply contradictory approach, isn't it? But the some elements of it are quite interesting.
Yeah, no, indeed. Well, we'll just pause the discussion there for a moment, because I'd like to get both of your thoughts after this about Elon Musk's involvement with Israeli companies and, indeed, regime change operations.
The history of Elon Musk's tumultuous love affair with Israel has had some fascinating twists and turns. Musk borrowed $1 billion to buy Twitter from Larry Ellison, one of the biggest known financiers of the Israeli military. Because of their close relationship, Ellison extended an offer to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to become a director of his software business, Oracle, and even was due to be a witness for Netanyahu at his delayed corruption trial. Additionally, Authentix, an Israeli company founded by former Israeli intelligence officials, is working with Musk on his X platform. The new ID verification process, which asks users to provide legitimate ID documents and selfies, is administered by Authentix. It is a project of the Dutch security company, ICTS International, which was established by former Shin Bet operatives. Musk and his Starlink satellites were also implicated in the failed regime change campaign against Iran. When U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken mentioned the necessity of the U.S. government supporting Iranian protesters, Musk responded immediately with the words, "activating Starlink." Musk then publicly boasted about donating, quote, 100 active Starlinks in Iran, end quote, to help regime change rioters communicate. Elon Musk is also working closely with Israel to combat the resistance axis in the region. Musk's company, SpaceX, launched spy satellites for ImageSat International, an Israeli intelligence firm, to identify targets for airstrikes in Syria. The company's CEO, Noam Sigal, is an Israeli Air Force reservist. ImageSat International has been a critical component in Israel's 1,000 attacks on Syria in the past years. Both ImageSat International and the Israeli Embassy in the United States officially thanked Elon Musk for the launch of their spy satellite above Syria on his X platform. Will his next service to Israel be the censoring of pro-Palestinian voices on the platform? Time will tell.
David, so this ImageSat International, just say a bit about its role then. I mean, it's mentioned in the video there, in the Israelis' bombing campaign in Syria.
So it's the tech which allows them, in part, the intelligence and the operational ability to carry out these attacks, 1,000 attacks roughly over the last few years. Attacks which have gone almost entirely unanswered, unremarked in the Western media. There's not been the capacity in the Syrian government to or at least not